Hey, Andrew? Andrew? Hey,
what's up?
Hey, dude. I gotta show you something really quick before we start recording today. It's
What is that?
It's like if a Rubik's Cube decided to be like way more complicated, and I can't do a Rubik's Cube, but this is like that. But it's like all metal and such. Here, wanna hold that?
Yeah, I'll what happened? I'm gonna twist this part. This isn't really like a Rubik's Cube, Justin. This is like
it's the best way I can describe it. It's like a puzzly looking thing, and it's cute.
Well, you're doing pretty good,
actually. Yeah.
I think if I push this part here,
yeah, it was like.
Oh God.
Okay.
Hello, gentlemen.
No! I just. No, you know,
fish hooks and chains time. No,
I just like, I need you to know there's something on your face and it's a lot of it. So...
Yes, those are good. I like that they're there.
Welcome to Nothing New Remake Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Justin Keyson, and over on his mic is.
Hi, I'm Andrew Lindy. And we are joined by a special guest.
Hello, everybody.
Yeah.
I'm Lilith.
AKA Pinhead for...
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The world deserves, Pinhead is a woman now. Pinhead is a trans woman now, specifically. Mm-hmm. And so I'm happy to take on the role.
Fantastic. We are deathly afraid of the pins on the head. Now,
right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Today, we will be talking about the 1987 film Hellraiser
and Hellraiser 2022.
This is. Hey, it's Halloween month. It's spooky time.
It's spooky times. I love me some spooky times. It's my excuse to just shove a bunch of horror movies in my eyes, and I'm looking forward to that. Now, Lilith, we'll get to you in a moment, but I want to ask Andrew first, what's your history with Hellraiser, and maybe how did you first hear about this series?
I probably first heard about Pinhead from Mad Magazine, to be quite honest. Because I was a scaredy cat for a long time. Didn't watch a lot of horror movies. It was it's a really recent thing that I've gotten into horror movies, and Hellraiser has been one that I've held off on. Oh, did I lose you?
No, I'm right here.
Oh, okay.
Hellraiser is the one you held off of?
I did held off. I held, yeah, thanks. Thanks. Okay, so it's because I knew specifically that it's gross. I can't deal with gore. Gore is the one thing that I am not able to handle in films, and yet I will still, now I watch more horror movies, so I guess I can handle it now. I don't know.
My experience with Hellraiser, it was always that franchise that was there as a kid, and it's the one where there are a couple of franchises growing up where if the commercial was on, I ran away from the television. not turn off the TV, I ran away from it, because that's the logical answer from my head as a child. So whenever a commercial for Hellraiser popped up on television, I just went nope, and it just ran off the other direction. I did get around to watching the first two when I was in high school, and I have a lot of fondness for those first two. I haven't gone past that. But Lilith, I hear you're a bit of a fan.
I do enjoy the Hellraiser movies. Unfortunately, I mean, I enjoy the good Hellraiser movies, and there's a lot of unfortunately, it doesn't go well. Whole lot further past what you've seen. I watched the first one with my ex-wife. She kind of introduced me to the universe or whatever. And then in the past couple of years, a friend of mine and I were like, oh, let's watch all the Hellraiser movies together. And we watched the first one, which, of course, I loved it. Second one is incredible.
Yeah.
There's so much cool stuff that the second one has. Mm-hmm. The third one has the actress who played Jadzia Dax in it, and that's a good thing for it. but at that point I had heard basically that it just goes down from there. And if it goes down from the third Hellraiser movie, that's a pretty far way to go down. So I kind of said, hey, you know, the 2022 remake's coming up, so maybe I'll just hold off on Hellraiser for a little bit.
The second one I kind of adore. It's really, like you said, it's got some really cool shit in it. And
the fucking like labyrinth of the Hellraiser dimension with like the cool fucking like obelisk in the sky.
Yeah.
Like,
it's
holy shit.
Oh, I just like, there was a period with me and my best friend in high school after we watched it. Like we would kind of quietly quote to each other. We look at each other and went, a battle you want to have, hey? You know? And it's just, it's very cool. But I've never gone past that. And am I wrong? I think Pinhead went to space at one point.
Where there's like a weird like space station that's shaped like a fucking lament configuration.
Oh my gosh.
It's, yeah. I haven't seen it, but I saw like a gif of like the space station exploding or something, and I was like, holy shit, I might actually need to seek that one out at some point, because that sounds wild. In the third one, there's I'm sorry, I just want to talk about this for a little while.
Please.
The main character who's played by, I'm forgetting her name, but the actress who plays Jadzia Dax, which is two DS9 actors who have been in the Hellraiser series, because one of the main guys in the first one is Garrick.
Yeah, you're right.
Andrew Robinson.
Thank
yeah.
you. Yeah.
but she's like a TV reporter. And her cameraman friend gets turned into a fucking Cenobite who has like a camera lens coming out of his face, and he like shoots CDs at people. It's so fucking cool.
Oh, I kind of love that.
yeah. Well, this franchise always have its weaknesses, but the one thing that manages to seemingly consistently do is creative violence, which is something I'm always on board for. So,
okay, cool. That's actually legitimately sounds cool. I might just find that clip alone.
Right.
Okay, so we've let's go ahead and let's just dive into the first film.
Yes.
Clive Barker's directorial debut. Interesting career Clive Barker has. Not the most consistent directing career, but you know, fascinating start. And this is one of those cases where it's like, wait.
Oh no, we've lost. Uh-oh.
Who we lose? Andrew?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I think I lost y'all. Oh, no.
I can hear you now. Okay. Can you hear me?
Okay. I can hear you. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I knew I had trouble because when you're describing the CD shooting man, I laughed, and then Discord heard me laugh and then said, and now you hear nothing.
Uh-huh. Said
that's
what?
Not great.
Andrew? Damn it.
Oh, no.
Nothing again.
Andrew?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Yeah, it seems like you're kind of coming in and out.
Yeah.
Well, that's fun.
Oh, boy.
I don't know. Okay. I don't know why the internet decided not to play nice today.
Mm-hmm. Let's push on.
Yeah, I'll just have to edit all these little chunks out.
Sorry. Okay, we're talking about Clive Barker. Okay. Now, Clive Barker, you know, famed author, novelist. And unlike a certain other famous author who attempted at directing, somehow his first attempt, far better than another very famous author.
You're referring to perhaps Mr. Stephen King.
I might be referring to Mr. Stephen King.
Who in a recent Patreon episode,
we picked to remake. We pitched our remake of Maximum Overdrive. And our pitch is pretty. Look, we can only go up from what King did with Maximum Overdrive.
I don't think that there exists enough cocaine on the planet at this point to do justice to his original creative vision for Maximum Overdrive. I don't think you can remake Maximum Overdrive at this point. You can't be that coked out anymore.
That's first off correct.
Part of our pitch was definitely just get as many character actors in there as possible.
Yeah.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, for yeah. sure. So unlike Maximum Overdrive, Barker seemingly fared better and at least got to do a couple more movies after that. I'm just curious, has anybody actually read the book or the stories this was based on? The Hellbound Heart.
I've wanted to. I was looking at like the kind of like the plot synopsis of The Hellbound Heart, and like it actually seems fairly similar, except that Kirsty isn't like related. Kirsty's just like a friend of the family in The Hellbound Heart.
Interesting.
But other than that, seems almost beat for beat, maybe setting wise a few changes, but seems pretty close to what ended up in Hellraiser.
Okay. That's fascinating to hear. That was Christie's original.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like that's where Clive, the writer from the book decided the Clive Barker decided who wrote the screenplay is like, hey, I could probably clean this up a little bit.
Yeah. Like give her a little bit more of a reason to like stick around, because like if you think about the story of the first Hellraiser movie, if she's just a friend, I think she's bouncing like pretty quick.
You know what? I'm Larry, Julia, I'm out.
This sucks.
You're on your fucking own. Here's the thing. I feel like folks who, if they're not familiar with the first film, they probably assume Pinhead is a major and the Cenobites are like major obstacles that constantly happens throughout the movie. So I think it's interesting that when you watch the first Hellraiser, some folks are probably going to be actually surprised to realize that there's actually very little Pinhead.
So little screen time.
Yeah.
I was extremely surprised, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
When the movie is going, and once there is an opening part, you have to start, you know, it's the convention in a horror film like this. You have to start with a little kill, a little tease at what's to come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we start with that, but then we get into like the kind of melodrama that's going on between like a husband and wife moving into a home, and their marriage isn't maybe not the greatest, and there's a daughter, and there's a, you know, just all this kind of drama and the weird little the tryst that occurred and the other romance going on. It's like, oh, there's a lot going on here that isn't just like people picking up a box and getting hurt by it.
right.
It's actually a lot more, in a weird way, it's a lot more kind of like just like it's almost, I wouldn't say like a, okay, is it weird to say it's almost like a weird serial killer movie for a period of the time?
Oh, well, yeah. She has to bring back the men for him to absorb.
Yeah.
Which is killing them. So it's kind of like that. It play, you know, it's playing in that idea of like, what would you do for love or lust? Mm-hmm. And she's asked to murder, and she says, okay, I'll do it.
She is so easily sold on that idea.
Yeah. Like, she sees the skinless man, and she's like, yeah, you're the man that I want to have sex with, so let's bring all that skin back.
Yeah. Like, obviously, you know, the passion's going to come back once the flesh and skin are back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sure of this.
It's very interesting because in everything in, you know, juxtaposition of itself, and the fact that Clive Barker also did Candyman, it kind of puts me to mind of a Candyman kind of forbidden romance that's kind of central to Candyman's like backstory. Which I thought was interesting. You have this kind of a disfigured person who's, you know, searching for their love.
I mean, Clive Barker is, I think, first and foremost, just a weird pervert who you know, like I mean, you when he talks about like the, you know, the original conception of what Hellraiser, you know, he was hanging out in BDSM clubs and he was like, what if these were like crazy? Like, what if these were like demonic? And it just kind of went from there, and like, great. Cool.
That answers so many questions. It's like, when you find out about that backstory, you're like, you know what? That sounds right. You
know? Yeah. I think, wait, no, I, cause there was an original, based on the Hellbound Heart. When he directed and wrote the film adaptation, Barker considered naming the film Sadomasochists from Hell, which would not have been nearly as iconic of a title.
No,
but it's like a little title of a 50s movie.
Yeah.
It's a little wordy, Clive. Uh-huh. Can we pare that down a bit? it's a little wordy. And I guess I also saw that he also initially wanted to title the film Hellbound, which is which I think the producers suggested to make it Hellraiser, but Hellbound ended up being the title for Hellbound Hellraiser 2. When we were doing that fun period where there was like the title colon sequel.
right.
That was Omen 2 was like that as well. Damien colon Omen 2.
Rambo colon First Blood Part 2,
of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
We should probably bring that back. I'd rather and have
the,
that back.
Well, Justin, I'm surprised you haven't mentioned the biggest one.
Oh, please. Go ahead.
Wasn't it the Lost World?
Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
You're not wrong. I kind of prefer that over the, it's the same title as the original movie, except it comes out this year. Halloween
2018. Oh, God. Exhausting.
Yes, very. So let's kind of talk about the general look of the film. It's
so cool.
Yeah. So cool. And in a surprisingly low budget, $1 million, which is even back then, that's still kind of on the lower tier. The aesthetics of this movie is just really cool.
The light, the way that they do like all of the lighting, like it's just so like so purposeful and so like creepy and weird in like all the best ways. The way that what's her name, the Julia, the way that Julia is lit in like every fucking scene, like with the way the light catches her eyes, or like, you know, when she's like looking down at Kirsty down the stairs, like the way she's underlit is just like so fucking unsettling.
Yeah,
so cool.
It's one of those things Go ahead, Andrew. Go ahead.
No, and I think the like you said, underlit on the stair, like the stairs and the house itself are so good. Like you don't just have like this idea of these, you know, sadomasochists from hell. It's the idea that, oh, it's also kind of a haunted house.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Which helps all of the aesthetic, all of the look come together, because it's like pretty much, you know, this location is the important place. And, you know, everything looks cool in it, like in the house.
Oh, no.
And there's kind of a cool thing, like along with like the way that the house is, that kind of ties into, I think, part of the themes of the film, where like there's a lot of the house that is what you could see a suburban family, like what is presented to you, settling down in. And then there's this fucked up room where Frank had a fucking, you know, heroin den in, and that's where all the like gore is, and like the fucking windows are like covered in paper and shit like that. Like there's just a couple like completely fucked up rooms.
Yeah. Yeah. That room that clearly was Frank's coked out sex room.
Yeah.
Just one of those, even before he opened the damn box. It's just one of those things where I'm just like, I guess I'm kind of glad you found a way to just put that all in the one room.
Yeah, right?
It wasn't
The rest of the house he didn't really care to use. And so when he was, you know, like dead for a little bit, all the bugs and rats and everything came out, which just adds to like kind of the grossness of everything that's going on.
No. The amount of gross that this movie builds up on, it's a build too, hilariously enough. It does start like, oh, Frank left the room like this. That's cool. Thanks, Frank. And then it gets gnarlier and more gnarly as the story goes. Also, it's like it's one of those cases where it's like the makeup effects is one of those cases where it's like it's got a charm of like 1980s-ness, but also like it's now very clear, like, oh, these, you know, we have kind of evolved on our makeup effects to look a little more realistic to a certain degree. So there's almost a like teenager Halloween, you know, like vibe to like the makeup effects nowadays. Like the sort of like almost plastic-ish look that, you know, looked freaky back then, but ages into that, where I just feel like, oh yeah, this is what I've seen in like someone's homemade haunted house, and I'm still into it. I'm just pointing out it's just changed a little.
I will say though that the scene where Frank, you know, becomes whole again, that's a cool scene. Like,
it's a,
you know, as much as I am like, I'm like, oh, gore is like gross. That's cool because it doesn't look, you know, real in that sense to me. I can't deal with like realistic gore. Like this is just like, I'm appreciating the craft of like, this is a visual effects, you know, like this is not a computer. This is somebody like got the goo, you know, squished it, made it look just right. It was nice. I was like, this is cool.
That's one of the sequences where you can just sort of see everyone going all in on. And like, I know exactly how we're going to film this, and all the makeup of folks, right? Oh, we know how, we totally know what we're going to do here. And it just, like, partial pun intended, comes together so well.
Yeah. The other, like, at the near the beginning, when Frank initially, like, cuts his, or no, when Larry cuts his hand and he goes into that room and he's bleeding on the floor and the blood like seeps down and you see the like weird like gore under the floorboards that it's like absorbing into. That was an incredibly good looking sequence. Just cool.
I think that's kind of the case of just like utilizing, that's the clever filmmaking that does happen in this movie. It's like this clever use of like practical effects, lighting, Jesus. And you know, look, I was looking up, like Barker has directed before he made this movie. He's done some short films. But this is his first real like attempt, his first real, you know, chance to really do a feature film. And so I'm sure like, you know, clearly there was a lot where he had to learn making this movie. I read a story mm-hmm. where it's like he was very much like, you know, the cast and crew were very patient with me as I was trying to figure this out. And the crew specifically where they would ask me, what lens do you want to swap? And I'm like, I'm sorry, what now? You know? But very clearly, the vision was clear and he knew what he wanted from the look of it.
Yeah. 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 And I mean, he made this is a classic movie. Like, mm-hmm. I love this movie.
Mm-hmm. It's a real like look at like, and it's funny. I never viewed this movie as like a way to look at a low budget horror film in that, mm-hmm. but as I'm watching it recently, I was like, oh, I guess it kind of is. And this is a really good, because it really just embraced the setting and its limitations and its smaller cast mm-hmm. really, really well. Andrew, now how were you able to handle the horror on the gore on this movie overall?
Oh, I was fine. You know, it wasn't, you know, the parts where they do the hooks to the skin are the way that's shot and like edited is so kind of careful where mm-hmm. it's never too much, but it's just even the sound and then just that brief flash of the hook piercing the skin is just like, oh my God. It's like, it'll get to me, but I can deal with it because it's not kind of like sustained, you know, mm-hmm. gore or anything. I mean, even I talk about gore, but it's like in a TV show when someone like has to do like an injection, I can't even look. I'm just like, oh
wow.
I can like feel it on my skin. I'm just like, ugh. It just really freaks me out. I don't know. I get over it. I watch these things. It's fine. I don't think I'll be, you know, watching. I don't know. I did hesitate. I was gonna watch Hellraiser 2 and probably 3 as further prep for this, and I hesitated and I watched other horror films instead. And with the two of you talking so highly of Hellraiser 2, I regret that. I think I will get to at least 2. In watching. But yeah, I know that there's like 10 of them. There's like 10 Hellraiser movies.
Yeah, yeah.
It can't. Mm-hmm. I can't do that. I feel like I have to draw the line somewhere.
I would never tell you to do that.
I mean, just because it's the other Clive Barker thing that I can reference, the Candyman, like the gore in Candyman, I was like, even really, really grossed out because he has that like exposed rib cage full of mm-hmm. bees or whatever. I was just like, oh, like that's just so gnarly to look at. But yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
I guess Pinhead doesn't, looking at him doesn't freak me out that much.
Real quick aside, I was just scrolling through the Wikipedia for the Hellraiser, like the series.
Yeah.
And I don't even know which one this is. I think it's something like 7 or 8. Mm-hmm. But just the first sentence, taking place in the real life world in which the Hellraiser franchise has spawned a successful MMORPG. Oh. 5 friends mourn the death of one of their fellow players who committed suicide after becoming obsessed with the game. And then the fucking Hellraisers get him. The fucking Cenobites get him. That's...
What the...
Oh my God.
What?
Now that makes sense to me. I don't
know.
That's so fucking cool.
that is just, oh man, how do we get the kiddies interested in Hellraiser?
Yeah. We put World of Warcraft into Hellraiser.
Hell, oh my gosh. Hellraiser.
What would a game based on Hellraiser even be like? Like, just don't solve the box? Like,
and not only just a game, but an MMORPG.
Mm. Oh my God.
Are you doing, in the you're doing quests for Chatterer? Oh, Chatterer needs a toothbrush. Better go pick one up for him. There's a spooky toothbrush down at the market, at the evil market.
So, this is FYI. This is Hellraiser Hellworld. And I believe this is the 8th installment. And,
yeah, the 8th.
Jesus, and this is in fact the final one starring Doug Bradley as Pinhead, which I feel like it's time to talk about Doug Bradley. I know he's not in this movie a lot, but anyone have any kind of initial thoughts about Doug Bradley as Pinhead?
Incredible. Like, just a instantly iconic performance. Like one of those things where you see something like that and it almost feels like, you know, like I feel like a lot of you hear about this from a lot of like Star Wars actors or anything like that. And I'm sure Doug Bradley's career kind of went the same way. I don't know how you get another job after being Pinhead. Cause you're just Pinhead.
Yeah.
So, iconic is really the only thing that I can say. Like, the voice, the physical presence, the design of Pinhead. I know that's not really on Bradley, but, like, oh, my God. It's so good.
The design, like, obviously, and it's so funny because he's not even credited as Pinhead in the first movie. It's lead Cenobite. But it's such a... It's like that design alone is already memorable, but the fact that Doug has just this sort of aura to him is, and again, short amount of time. I guess that's the thing, right? Like, that's how you know someone has a presence, is that, like, he's only in the movie, what, maybe 10 minutes? Like, tops? And yet,
tops.
Yeah, but you feel that he's in the movie more because of just how much... he's like in his scenes, and he's so just, again, holds everything in there.
I have to say, I was more scared of the I believe she's just credited as the female Cenobite, the one with the open throat.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Because there's I think I was reading that there's a line that she has that originally wasn't even hers. It was supposed to be Butterball had a line, but the actor could not make the mouth move under all that makeup. So she got this line. Well, I can't remember what the line was, but I remember when she did the line, I was just like, oh, that's scary. Like, the way that she's talking is exactly what I imagine it would sound like if your throat was open like that. Yeah. It's kind of like gaspy and raspy.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's like just her. She's just doing that. And that's just perfectly like horrifying. That was the Cenobite that left the biggest impression on me. But I can't see, obviously, you know, Doug Bradley, he's clearly meant to be, he's credited as a lead Cenobite, so it's like he has more to do and more to say. But yeah, I think doesn't she get more to do in the sequels? Maybe I read that wrong, but it's just like, that is the other Cenobite where I'd be like, I want to see a little more of her doing something.
In two, all the Cenobites get a lot more screen time because we spend a lot more time in the like Cenobite world.
I'm a big, just by visuals alone, I'm a big fan of chattering Cenobite.
Of course. Yeah.
Just pure visuals alone. It's almost like he's like the second most famous Cenobite for most folks. It's Pinhead and then Chatterbox, chattering Cenobite. Is he called Chatterbox in the fan base?
I call him the Chatterer, but that's, I don't know where I'm getting that from.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, I knew that Butterball was called Butterball before watching this movie. And I think again, that might've been just the influence of Mad Magazine. They couldn't have done better than Butterball, so they kept that in their parody version.
That's the, like, what, how are you going to make a funnier joke than Butterball? That's the joke you would have, that's what they would have called him if Mad Magazine didn't decide to do that joke already. But unfortunate name, Butterball. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Butterball, but that's what you look like. Talk a bit. I kind of want to talk a bit. We've been going on a lot about the mood, the visuals. But I kind of do want to address, like, how does everyone feel about the general, our general leads of the story? You know, Christy, Larry, Julia, Frank.
I want to say, I had that thing where I was kind of wondering, is everyone British pretending to be American? Or just British without a strong accent. I was just so thrown by. Everyone seems British. That's really what got me. Especially Larry.
Yeah, the original story took place in England, which is, I think they just transposed it. But yeah, it did kind of seem like, well, Julia definitely had an accent.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure. Larry, I think, just kind of sounded like Andrew Robinson for the most part.
But Frank is like American, like he's not British at all.
He's you know, he like, he's talking in a very American accent.
In that scene where we get to see him like in the flesh when he meets Julia for the first time or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he's practically, he's like wearing like, isn't it like a motorcycle jacket? Like he's, he might as well be wearing like an American flag. In the rain, like he is just like, he's like, oh, I'm macho.
So I found out, if we're going by the wiki, that apparently, after filming, New World Studios, convinced Barker to relocate the story to the US, but that meant redubbing.
Oh my God. That's, I remember hearing about that.
Yeah. So I guess that's the prop. That's why we're all kind of thrown off by the accents in the movie, is that like it was originally supposed to be, you know, set in London, and then New World went, no, make it American. And then Clive Barker's like, oh shit.
There's a part where it's like Kirsty and her love interest are going into like a subway, but I'm like, I was like waiting for them to call it the tube. I was like, where are we? How are we going to find out? Yeah. Like where we are. And they just never refer to it as anything. They just walk down some stairs and get a kiss.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very, and which to me, I like the, that subway is like, that is a very, 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 very London looking subway entrance. So it does cause a little confusion as to where we're at, story wise. But I guess it just shows the strength of everything else that I just went odd, but I'm rolling with it. I'm going with it.
One of the things about Larry, about specifically about Andrew Robinson's performance that I remarked to my girlfriend while I was watching it, it just the absolutely delicious contrast between Andrew Robinson's performances in DS9 and in Hellraiser, where in DS9 he is playing the most like devilishly interesting homosexual, and in Hellraiser he is playing the most perfectly boring heterosexual in equal measure. Like he really goes to both extremes in a very talented way. I admire that.
Wow. I had not looked up this actor, Andrew Robinson, and he was the killer in Dirty Harry.
Oh,
I'm like,
wow.
I would never have thought that was the same guy. That's crazy. I mean, was that 16 years apart? But
yeah,
my goodness. Yeah. But you know what range? I didn't even know.
No, it's so funny. I didn't realize at first that he was Garrick until you brought it. Until you Lilith, you brought it up and went, wait a minute. Oh my God, it is. It took a moment, and then I'm like, oh my God, oh my God. This is like me finding out that like the alien friend in The Last Starfighter is the old man in RoboCop. I didn't know that.
Right,
and I'm like, no, surely that's not the same. Oh, it is the same actor. Holy shit. Because you're right. It's so funny. Like he is so boring, vanilla dad in this movie. You know, don't worry, Christy, I'll be fine. That's the kind of level of his character.
The scene where they have the little dinner party and Julia is just like so annoyed with all of his little stories that he's telling to all of his friends,
yeah.
and he's just like so thrilled with himself, like talking about like, I'm gonna sue that doctor, he almost made me pass out. So perfect.
Yeah, I know.
So perfect.
Yeah. It's interesting to point out too that Frank technically is played by two actors.
Yeah.
Sean Chapman as Frank Witskin. and then Oliver Smith, skinless Frank. And it's very clear that it's two different actors.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm just curious. So what do you two think is the reason why they went in that direction? Just curious before I kind of figure it out.
Go ahead, Lilith. Yeah.
So my thinking is just that, you know, they wanted to have, you know, the character of just this like dude oozing sexual charisma, who like, you know, that is what Frank is, especially, you know, at the beginning of the movie when he's, you know, when he does that, you know, he has experienced sensation to the point where he is now seeking out otherworldly things, including being tortured to death by demons. And I think just having that be portrayed separately to a pitiful weird creature that is like begging to, you know, kill for me so that I can be alive again, like I think there is like a necessary split there. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you might be able to find, like, if you had, you know, if you did a straight remake of this movie with where you were making the exact same plot, you know, and you found somebody with a lot of range,
mm-hmm.
they could do that. But I don't think on the budget that this movie had,
mm-hmm.
you can really find a guy who's going to be able to pull off both roles that well.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. Especially that makes sense to me, because especially the way that Frank is just Frank, skinless Frank.
Yeah.
Like he is quite literally seen some shit.
yeah save me, you know, like that kind of thing. Like I feel like comes off very differently than like the, you know, the smooth talking badass
whose hair is wet in the perfect way for sex, mm-hmm. for maximum sexy.
I want to talk about, I want to mm-hmm. jump please. Into a scene, just kind of jumping around, but I want to just get through it. Like the scene where, I don't remember exactly how it goes down, but Kirsty gets the box from, Frank.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And she escapes the house, but she's seen too much, you know, like, it's crazy what she's seen. And she she's like running away from the house. She has like blood on her and mm-hmm. she passes out. And then she kind of wakes up while people are asking her questions. And then she wakes up in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And I was very intrigued in this hospital scene, because kind of the way that the hospital scene plays out, I felt like that was the start of her being trapped by the box already. I was like, this already seems like part of the sadomasochist experience, because she doesn't have...
Yeah.
you know, bodily autonomy. She is like
mm-hmm.
locked in this room. The doctor and the nurse won't tell her anything. They won't let her make a phone call, you know? And then the doctor has this kind of sinister way of being like, you were holding on to this box. Did it mean something to you? And like gives it to her. And it's like,
yeah,
why would you do that as a doctor? Like all of it felt kind of otherworldly to where I was like, are we already here? I was very ready to be already in, you know, her trap that she's already mm-hmm. been set in. But then she does solve the box and it opens the wall, which is very cool. I love all of the wall opening stuff that goes on, where it's and it literally is another dimension. It is like just beyond our mm-hmm. walls. Like that's really cool.
Not to get too personal. here on a movies podcast, but as somebody who has been in psychiatric inpatient care, sometimes it fucking is like that.
Yeah.
Sometimes doctors really are just like, well, we'll let you know when, you know, like you ask them questions and they're just like, and then they leave the room without telling you anything, and then you're just locked in a room. It's fucking wild like that.
Wow, jeez.
I mean, you know, I think that is a really interesting like parallel that they were kind of able to draw on there. That just like it is this kind of like, you know, there's things on Earth that are uncomfortably close to what the Cenobites will do to us, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, woo. I mean, and then that acts, I mean, her solving the puzzle, it acts as a way for her to escape that.
Right.
And so it kind of shows, like, beyond the Frank angle of, like, mm-hmm. I've done every drug and had all kinds of sex. Let me find the next level. This is like, this is another way that someone would seek out the box for a way out. Right. Like I feel like that's what it was trying to say. Once I got through the scene, I was like, oh, okay. I think they're trying to show that kind of angle. I did enjoy, but only in the way where I enjoyed it, 'cause it was a little bad. The part where, when she does go down that hallway and the creature that comes after her,
yes.
Oh, yeah.
Only because, to my eye, I could 100% see the man in the suit that was that creature, which was a person wearing something black to cover their legs, the whole creature suit, and their arms were the legs on the walls, and they're just taking their hands and touching the walls as they're running, which is a very funny visual to me, that a person doing that would make this creature, and they were like, yeah. This is good. This is scary. Very funny to me.
See, I'm trying to see, like, what else?
Once she gets, I mean, she gets the box, it all kind of, once she sees Frank and gets the box and then meets the Cenobites in the hospital room, that's really, we're really cooking with gas, you know? Like, that's where, and I mean, I kind of enjoy that she's shrewd enough to make the deal.
Yeah.
Where she's like, wait, I don't want to get taken. What if I could tell you about someone who escaped you? And they're like, no one escapes us. And she's like, someone did. Like, I'm like, ooh, that's such an interesting angle for this movie to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because making a deal with a Cenobite, you know, it's like, I mean, they are, you know, described as demons, like making a deal with a devil. Like, it's like, you don't know if you can trust what deal you're making, but it's the only thing you can do. So she does it. It's pretty, it's pretty cool.
You know, I'll even say, like, there is sort of a nice mild flip of sort of horror tropes where instead of like this, the, you know, when Julia starts bringing in, you know, men to kill so that Frank could have his skin back. The normal convention would be a male character bringing women in to do the same thing. So I'll even say it's a mild enough flip that I found that even refreshing. The idea that Julie is the one doing this, that Frank is kind of, you know, at the end of the day, he's like, hey, can you do my homework really quick? Well, you know, that's the vibe I'm getting from Frank in this movie. And it does shake it up a little bit, even in the 1980s standards. Boy, howdy, do I love how wild this ending gets. You're right, Andrew. It does turn the film is actually shockingly more of a haunted house vibe than I think people are expecting. And it's not properly a haunted house film, but it's got more of those vibes to it. But down to the fact that the house is kind of like a character that also gets killed during the finale.
Right.
And then a fucking dragon demon thing?
Yeah,
that one I can't understand that. Like, I'm like, well, They had to have a big ending, I guess.
I kind of love them. I kind of love it, because it is so left field. It's to a certain degree, but it still feels right, where it's like, oh, like, you know, you've seen all, you know, the Cenobites and these elements of hell, but here's a flat out, like, fucking, like, almost give this thing a pitchfork.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Real demon from hell, with wings and everything. Mm-hmm. I kind of love it. Horns and all, it's like, oh, you want hell? Here's a fucking hell demon. You know? And flies off at the end. And
that was, like, that guy had been watching Kirstie.
Yeah.
Before she even had the box, which mm-hmm. is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. The movie opens with the, Frank is buying the box, and the guy selling it to him is mm-hmm. like, it's always belonged to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, you know, does the box sense where it's going? Like, what is this guy who's selling the box another Cenobite in human clothes? Like the man who turned into a dragon, you know, like it's, there's a lot going on there.
A lot.
The other big question that I had was, now I can only see this kind of two ways. At the end, is it that when Frank takes the life force of Larry and kills him and takes his life force, he gains the skin of the last person that he took, or that he skinned Larry and then put that on?
I think he skinned Larry and put it on. That's my interpretation.
I mean, yeah, he's got that because, blood. Like, you the can blood see, on the head like, really the feels seams. Like he's wearing the skin
yeah.
suit.
Yeah. 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 And I think I thought I remembered a moment there was Christy bumping into a skinless body that I assumed was probably Larry's body.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the interesting thing about this is that if this worked out and Julia was alive to get to the end with Frank, even though I'm sure Frank really didn't care about the life of Julia. That, like, if that worked out, Julius technically would still be with Larry. Visually. You
know? Yeah, that's how they cover it up. Yeah.
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 That's true. That is how they would cover it up. You're right. But, you know, that's her choice, I guess. but she didn't make it out. So,
No.
Kirstie made it.
Kirstie made it.
Her guy made it. Yeah, he was kind of barely in the movie.
Yeah,
he's kind of a blip. Yeah,
barely a presence.
Barely a presence. Yeah, it's like, oh right, like it's been a while since I've seen this movie. So I'm like, all right, there was like a dude that like went out on a date with her. Okay, I completely forgot about that. But okay, I think that does wrap up at least our conversation about Hellraiser 1984. So we are going to go ahead and take a short break. And hear some ads. We'll come right back and see what happens when we bring up Hellraiser in 2022.
Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Diet Coke. And we have a new podcast that we would love for you to listen to.
It's called The 10 in 10 in 10. And it's all about the 2007 film, The 10.
Yeah, it's directed by David Wayne. I liked it when I saw it in 2007. Andrew didn't.
And I didn't.
Is that still true? We don't know. 10, but we got 10 minutes each episode, and we got 30 seconds for this 7, promo, and it's coming up 6, on the end. So go 5, listen, January 10th. 4,
3,
thank
2,
you.
1. Goodbye.
Welcome back. Go ahead, keep fiddling with that puzzle box. See if you can solve that there.
Ow,
while you're trying
ow,
to solve
ow,
that.
Ow, ow,
yeah.
ow. Sorry.
You know, we have a Patreon. Patreon.com/nothingnew. Where every month we release a bonus episode that usually coincides with what we're talking about in our main episode. And, you know, I think I'll open the curtain to the hell world. I mean, Patreon world. And let you have a listen of what that sounds like this month.
And I think the interesting thing about whatever happened to Baby Jane is the idea of casting two actors to pit against each other. In an interesting, you know, like to kind of like, okay, who would be the Bette Davis and Joan Crawford now to do that remake? As you can see, if you join our Patreon, we have such content to show you. God, I'm sorry. I had to make that reference once. So...
of course. That was so good.
But yeah, as low as $1 a month, of course, you can get all our old previous exclusive to Patreon-only episodes. Episodes that we have as of now, still no intention of ever putting onto our main feed. So the only way you can get them is through there. And again, a reminder that if you just pay a little bit extra, I believe it's $25, you can choose what we're going to talk about. You can pick the remake and the original film, and we will be under your control for that month. Previous episodes we've done that for have been Ninja Turtles, 1989 to 2014, thanks to Ken Rolo, Godzilla,
King Kong.
Yeah, that's the one. King Kong. My bad. I thought it was Godzilla. It was King Kong. And who did that one again? Do you remember?
That was Kent.
Kent. Okay.
Yes.
King Kong. 19.
And we have a few coming up soon.
Yes.
They'll be back to back, and they'll be a good time.
Yeah.
A good silly fun time.
Yeah. Specifically with the King Kong episode, I always want to bring up like that episode existed because of Kent, but I also. I'm glad because that meant that that's one of my personal favorite episodes of our show is the King Kong episode. And I thought that wouldn't have existed if it wasn't for the fact that someone said, hey, can you guys talk about this? So anything could help us on that regard. That'd be great. We're going to stop talking about our show for just a bit. Lilith, please tell the folks about your shows and where they could find you elsewhere.
Yeah. I'm at Death Carpets on just about any social media platform. If you want to just follow me, I'd say silly things on the internet. I have a couple podcasts I make. One of them with, I believe, friend of the show, Diet Coke. Mm-hmm. She and I make Diet Coke and Lilith's House of Snacks, a horror-themed snacks review podcast that's very fun and weird. That comes out weekly. It's on the Noise Space Network. I also make Ghost Puncher, which is a sort of multi-headed hydra of entertain. It used to be a comic. There's a tabletop RPG actual play podcast. There's a original tabletop RPG that was made to play on the podcast. It's a whole thing. You can find that all at ghostpuncher.net. You can find that there. And actually, talking about our mutual friend Diet Coke kind of leads me to I think a segue that we were going to make here, because when Andrew you asked me if I wanted to come on to talk about Hellraiser, I messaged Diet Coke and I was like, hey, so I'm not actually that familiar with Nothing New. How weird is it going to be if I'm like super horny for Jamie Clayton as Pinhead on Nothing New? And she was like, probably not like as explicitly horny as you sometimes get on House of Snacks, which it's weird that we do that on a snack show, but hey, what are you gonna do? But that brings me into what I think is my first thought about the new 2022 Hellraiser. I don't think it's that much of a problem because it's a pretty sexless movie. And I have a problem with that. I don't like that very much.
That's starting strong. And yeah. Starting strong on a point that I'm going to say, you're right.
Strong agree.
Strong agree. Very strong agree, especially knowing the birth of the origin of the concept.
Right. is like this is these are just this is just supposed to be like, you know, BDSM demons, you know, ripping people apart to bring them to the edge of sensation. And we have this pretty like, yeah, it's gory and there's some cool concepts that are being bandied about, but like it's not a very horny movie, and that was disappointing.
It's funny because as I was watching it, I got to the end and I'm sitting there going like, okay, what's missing? Like I got to the end of the, I'm kind of jumping ahead, but I was getting to the end of the movie and I didn't quite figure out exactly what it was that made me go, this is off. And I don't know why. And I guess I had to take it from talking to other folks who've seen it to go, oh, it's not horny enough. But, ah, there it is.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Immediately wrong.
It's the only real pervert of the movie is a non-entity for 99% of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, whatever his name, the you know, the mysterious businessman who was secretly pulling the strings for the whole time.
Yeah.
And even him, like, you know, he was just trying to get out of the whole thing.
And it's a very safe, might I add, a safe way of showcasing he's like a hedonistic character, like,
yeah,
like, oh, he has the beginning of the film, you see this mansion and there's like a scene that shows people having public sex or a group sex, and then like that's it, that's all you get, that's all the see this guy runs a sexy mansion, that's well, that's the vibe I got.
And he doesn't even himself want to be, you know, he doesn't open the configuration so that he can be pulled apart by Cenobites. He lets somebody else get pulled apart by Cenobites so that he can be granted a wish by them, because that's how it works now.
Let's talk. The box is completely different between these two films.
Yes.
Yeah.
In a way that bothered me so much. Because they turned it from a personal, you do this, you get, you are the one, into like a game. They've gamified it. And this is, I think it's like a weird modern thing where we have to make things both mysteries and games.
Yes.
So the rules have to be clear, the lore has to be clear, but also it has to be like, oh, I need to follow the clues. Mm-hmm. So it was like, first, you know, her brother disappears, then and they find the box in the safe. So then they find out, oh, who owned that shipping container? Oh, who's that? Where did that guy live? Like, they have to follow the clues, which is so, like, such a weird current thing that happens in so many movies and TV shows now that it just, I'm like, why are we doing it like this? Why is the box, like, why can you she's weaponized it. Like,
why
main character at first accidentally, and then after that it's like every other time it's kind of like, oh yeah, I'm you're gonna die now, like I'm gonna pick you
to the point where, and this is what I flag on the play, I was hollering at how at mad I was, she fucking stabs Chatterbox with the box, and the Cenobites are like, well, rules are rules, and they pull Chatterbox apart with the fucking chain hooks. It's like, no. That's not how any of this works.
There
it really isn't.
It's I had a hard time seeing Hellraiser in this Hellraiser movie, and that's what's starting to really get to me. Like the main story here is like Riley, a recovering drug addict, because that's not a tired trope, and
and also it didn't matter through the whole movie. I feel like you put a character like that at the center of a movie that is Hellraiser,
yeah,
and it's like that should matter a lot.
Yeah,
like she should be tempted by the box.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's kind of like built into her backstory, and it just doesn't matter.
It doesn't. Yeah. All. No, it's like there's the metaphor is sitting right in front of them. That's the area they want to explore, and they never do it. So now, with like her being a recovering drug addict is character sheet bio crap. You know what I mean? Where it's like, mm-hmm. oh, and that's her backstory. Mm-hmm. Okay, and?
That's something for characters to yell about in the first 20 minutes, so then we can move on to the lore and the mystery chasing.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, mm-hmm. 100%. And I think that was trying to really get to me as I was watching it, as it kept going, and I'm like, this doesn't feel like Hellraiser. Like, mm-hmm. I'm getting two traditional characters with, like, oh, the brother's partner, the girl who they're friends with, Riley's like lover, and mm-hmm. and
when they showed that room full of people, I was like, oh, and now we're in a early 2000s horror film where we've just met all the future victims.
Good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Everyone's just like hanging out by their laptops and shit. and it just that kind of just, the more the movie kept going, the more I'm like, I don't know where Hellraiser's at. Mm-hmm. And outside of seeing a version of the puzzle box and then starting to meet the Cenobites, you know, throughout the story, I was kind of feeling like, I feel like you all want the vibes of Hellraiser, but not the themes that Hellraiser explores. You want to have the visuals that we loved so much from the first movie, but not like the nitty gritty, dirty stuff that lives within
the
those
stuff
stories.
That is, you know, like this is a temptation for perverts to like mm-hmm. get, you know, the like great, you know, the explorers of the great reaches of sensation or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Like if that had been, you know, this would have been like, one, hacky, and two, way hard to pull off. But like, if the thing was like, you know, oh, we can show you a high you've never fucking experienced before.
Yeah.
Like through pain and, you know, and like, I guess, but like, no, they couldn't have a protagonist who, you know, was like tempted or flawed. Like the temptation at the end was for her to possibly take them up on, you know, their fucking Cenobite wish granting powers, which she has already seen go horribly wrong, and so she's just like, I don't think I want that, which is an incredibly logical decision to make. Right. She does the thing that we're all screaming at horror movie protagonists to do, which is to just say, no, I don't think so. I'm going to leave now. Mm-hmm. And then she's fine.
Not to just focus solely on the ending, I feel like part of that was also like, it was almost like a weird buildup to a pun. Because then they allow Pinhead to have like this speech and then be like, you've chosen the lament configuration,
right?
Mm-hmm. And it's kind because of like, that's... okay, come on, like, just like, because she didn't choose the other L named configurations that are all the different things that you could have, so they had to go, oh yes, this is how we fit in the naming of the thing, you know, like, mm-hmm. So it was like, why did we build up to that? Who was that for?
I
that's generally the thing I kind of got from this movie, was just this like I don't know what you're building up to. I don't really know. And I like, look, I'm not rooting for Julia to kill a lot of guys to get Frank back, but it's mm-hmm. a motivation that made sense to me.
Yeah.
And it was a place for the story to go. I don't really care about anyone in this movie, and then and that's a vibe I get from a Friday the 13th movie, and that's not where I should be having that feeling.
No,
you know, for a Hellraiser movie, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. Hellraiser is supposed to make me feel mildly uncomfortable and I feel like this movie isn't doing that, and I to kind of go into a little bit of the history of the, like, it seemed like they've been trying to remake Hellraiser for a while. And even to the point where it looks like Barker was going to try to do it in 2007. Like he was going to come back and direct the remake, which I would have been, it's so funny. Andrew, that not to spoil our Patreon, but we sort of, that's sort of something that was tied into our Patreon.
We talked about something about that in the Patreon.
Yeah, and that's a little accidental, really, because it's a little bit of how we make the show. Most of the time we try to do the Patreon after the main recording, but due to scheduling, we record the Patreon first, and I just realized, hey, how about that? That's a nice tie into our Patreon. So
the Patreon isn't about any of the Hellraiser sequels. So everyone,
just be clear. So no. We did not watch Hell.
We wanted to have a fun Patreon.
If you want us to watch Hell World, I guess we could. You can pay us to do but there's no remake. There's no remake. Unless you give us $100, maybe I'll ask you. I'm putting that here right now. But no, like it would have been fascinating to see Barker, because he hasn't directed anything since Lord of Illusions. So yeah. It would have been interesting to see him direct a remake of Hellraiser. You know, especially with more experience and looking back on his career, and also since he hasn't done anything since Lord of Illusions, but that none of that remake plans ever worked out. Apparently Patrick Lucier and Todd Farmer, who did Jason X and I believe the Nicolas Cage Hell movie where he Drive Me to Hell, something like that. Yeah, probably that sounds accurate to me.
Nick Cage movie naming convention, just make it real on the nose.
Make it real. Drive Me to Hell. Drag Me to Hell. Or, but they looked like they were very close to actually getting that film made in 2011, but then it just didn't work out. I'm assuming a lot of that maybe because of the situation with the studio that Hellraiser is under at that moment, which was Weinstein Company, and
right.
So fair is what I'm gonna say. Drive Angry. Yeah. Drive Angry. That's the movie with Nick. That's the Nick Cage movie where it's kind of like a better Ghost Rider movie than the Ghost Rider movie he's been in. So there's a lot of ups and downs on the making of, on trying to remake Hellraiser, and I found that to be kind of fascinating. And David Bruckner, who is the director of this one, I've only seen one film he's made, and it's an interesting situation because I think he co-directed, or I'm thinking somebody else. Oh, no, I'm totally off. That's my bad. I mixed him up with it. Oh, yes. Oh, sorry. Yeah, he collaborated on the film called The Signal, which came out in 2007, which I think that was a three-director situation, The Signal. A pretty kind of fun, low-budget horror film that's got a really great style to it. But I didn't see much of his... I haven't seen any of his work since then, and I'll say it's a very nice-looking movie. Very vague, very big-budgeted film. But it feels off. Doesn't truly feel Hellraiser-y, you know.
The designs of the Cenobites are much less like they're more gory and much less like honestly sexy. You know, the original Pinhead, that leather long overcoat thing that he was wearing was it was cool.
None of the Cenobites in this make me feel like I want to say leather daddy, and I feel that's a problem.
right. And which is such a waste when you get someone as undeniably smoking hot as Jamie Clayton to be Pinhead.
Here we go.
I'm so sorry. I had to touch on it.
That's fair.
A little bit.
Go ahead.
I'm not familiar with Jamie Clayton at all. How are you familiar with
So she was she was Nomi in Sense8, and mm-hmm. she was in The L Word. I only watched a little bit of Sense8, honestly, and I like, fuck, if was I gonna watch the new The L Word? But Jamie Clayton is a, you know, she's a trans woman who is an actress, and she's a total smoke show. She's hot, when I heard, like, when they announced the casting, she just posted, like, a selfie of her on Twitter holding, like, the puzzle box, and she said, you know, with the captions, angels to some, demons to others, and I was like, I am going to fucking lose my mind at this movie, because it's gonna be Jamie Clayton playing Pinhead, but, like, yeah, and a lot of it has to do with, like, you know, this is gonna always be the problem with a 2022 remake of a classic 80s horror movie. You know, everything's fucking CGI. Everything mm-hmm. looks, you know, just like this kind of glowy, fakey stuff. Mm-hmm. Nothing looks goopy and gross. Everything just kind of looks like a video game. That being said, it's still, like, I'm glad it's not a horrible movie.
Mm.
It's just so anti what I want from Hellraiser that I'm disappointed, but, like, the I'm glad that we're getting, you know, a pretty decently regarded Hellraiser movie, like,
look,
the best since 2, I would say.
Look, I'm never gonna watch the other ones outside of 2, maybe 3, mm-hmm. as a curiosity. But
oh no, that MMO one kind of has me intrigued.
Okay, maybe if I get convinced to watch the MMO one. Maybe. I'll give you that.
Yeah.
But I guess when the bar is that low.
I wanted to bring up something about kind of like, yeah, the look of the Cenobites isn't, you know, it's kind of like just mutilated skin rather than
yeah.
mm-hmm.
leather outfits. But there's also, I thought, someone tell me if I'm reaching here or something, maybe I'm seeing something that isn't there, but I thought it was something that where they were trying to make it that each of the Cenobites had kind of a pin element on them.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
was kind of something that links all of them.
Mm-hmm.
One of them had the pins kind of in the mouth and the mm-hmm. other one in the chest. It was kind of like the pins are part of something to do with them. And the mm-hmm. and I kind of took it to be like Pinhead has the most pins, you know, like yeah. Pinhead's like
yeah. that's why
the
he...
leader because of that.
Yeah.
But and also on top of that. OK, so I watched the film on Hulu with subtitles
mm.
and in the official subtitle, Jamie Clayton is referred to as Pinhead.
Mm
hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they do, I think, only call her a priest, or she says that she's a priest. I think
Hell Priest even, is
yeah,
the name
she's
of
credited.
The character, both in the credits and in the novel. Mm. Like, that's, yeah.
So I think there's like an identity problem with Pinhead. You know, you can't, it's not like, some people argue that you shouldn't call Michael Myers Michael Myers, right? Like,
mm-hmm. like,
we need a name for our scary monster that we want to be scared of.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
they should have, I think they should have made a strong choice and just gone full Pinhead on this one.
Oh, pins throughout the whole body.
Yeah.
Just like a,
yeah.
like a porcupine.
Yeah, as much pins as they could get.
I did the one moment I think that I found the most like, I think the most Hellraiser-y in that it was, it did kind of touch on that like, kind of creepy, violent erotica kind of way when she pulls the pin out of her head and then like jabs it into like I think it was like the roommate. Like that was cool. I liked that.
Yeah.
I liked that a lot.
Nah, take that. I'll give you that. To take what you can get, right? It's
like, yeah.
Because, I mean, it's weird.
But and another weird, I mean, this is just such a weird small thing, but I also felt like the Cenobites' voices were too modulated.
Yes.
I was so distracted by that. I was like, why are we doing this? Why are we having to put them through the creepy filter? Just let them do like their own version of a creepy voice.
Yeah.
You know, like that I think would have been better.
Especially because it's not like Doug Bradley didn't have a little bit of a filter when in the original film, but like, I feel like, you know, like to really let Jamie's performance really come through clearer, maybe not so hard, not so heavy.
And my favorite from the original, the one with the open throat, who's referred to as the gasp.
Oh my God.
In this one, they just fully just auto tune or something her voice, where it's like, I'm like, this isn't even scary. Like, this is just like so fake.
And it's and it is funny because again, like I mentioned in about when we're talking about the original film, it's like, you know, there's a lot of people are going to be shocked to realize that the Cenobites aren't in it that much, if anything, 10 minutes. But here it's like the first note on remaking Hellraiser is like, yeah, Matt, you got to make sure there's a lot of Cenobites
and a lot of new ones. There's like two new ones that are just there with no words. They just stand there.
Yeah. No real identity in the way that the originals did too, you know, like Butterball chattering, you know, the gapping, like there was some character, at least some identity between the other ones. The newer ones, I just was like, oh, okay, there's some new ones, you know.
Yeah, and then when fucking Chatterbox died, I felt nothing. I was like, I felt nothing except for scorn that was the way that they were going to handle something like that.
Yeah.
I kind of going on a bigger level. I feel like one thing that's kind of occurred to me that would have just improved this movie so much is instead of doing the thing that if modern filmmakers are so obsessed with, this like third act twist of like, oh, we found out that you know that the scummy, you know, not boyfriend was working for the guy the whole time.
Yeah.
If we had found that out so much sooner and just had that like creeping sense of dread that he's kind of like ham-fistedly pulling the strings and like pushing them further into this, I think that would have made it so much better without changing a whole lot. I think that would have like really, you know, really, really pushed this movie in a much better direction.
Yeah,
that's a start.
Yeah,
for sure.
That's a better angle, honestly. And that's the thing. I guess it's so weird to see a movie that like has this gore, has all like, you know, like the like strong imagery, and yet I feel nothing throughout the majority of it. It's really odd. Whereas like I watched the original film and like the effects aren't as advanced as this new one, but yet I'm like invested in something in the original film. And whereas this one I'm like, yeah, it all looks very expensive.
You know? That's... Yeah.
Yeah. Even with, I mean, this had to have been a higher budget.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, even with a higher budget, more Cenobites, you know, more of what they think the audience wanted, all that they delivered was nothing new.
Please rate and review Nothing New, a remake podcast, on your podcast app.
You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at NothingNewPod.
You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/NothingNew.
Nothing New, a remake podcast, is part of the Benview Network.